is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you all taking time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with our esteemed cohort live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, we'll be there with others to monitor them. That's also a good place if there's a question or a point of order you would like to have us raise with our guests. If you put it in there, we will do our best to fold that into the next hour's conversation. And if you're with us and you got to take off and take care of some other business, remember, if you make the effort to go over to iTunes or Spreaker or any of the other aggregators and subscribe to the podcast, Midrats will always be waiting there for you to catch up on what you missed. Or if you miss us live, it'll be there when your work week allows you to come on board and join us. Getting on with today's show, today we're going to talk about a subject we have brought up many times during the course of the years, including with our guests, and that is the fact that the neglected state of the American merchant fleet and all the institutions it supports is a problem longstanding. And like a lot of problems that are longstanding, you can get used to it, but that doesn't mean you have to accept it or you can't bring it up. And oftentimes, problems that are long-standing get worse with age. And we've seen recently a lot of news break above the background noise about the merchant fleet. And a little bit of it, not enough in my mind, has come to the fore as everybody likes to talk about the great power competition at the other end of the Pacific. I don't think enough people have taken out a chart and look at what is between the major U.S. positions and resources and the Western Pacific, or have done the math on what it would take to sustain, not just initiate, but to sustain operations on that part of the globe. And today, our returning guest to Midrats to talk about really the larger issues with our merchant marine is Captain John Conrad. John is the founder and CEO of the maritime news site gcaptain.com and the author of the book Fire on the Horizon. Captain John Conrad, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Hey, and just to kind of kick it off, because we get new listeners all the time, and even for our regular established listeners and hardcore navalists, they may not often turn their thoughts and ideas towards the merchant marines, and especially this year, more than any, there's lots of distractions out there in a world dominated by not a 24-hour, but a 24-second news cycle. Why should busy people stop and think about the American merchant marine here in the end of September of 2020?
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. And, you know, 90% of everything, look around you in your office or in your car, your garage, wherever you're listening to this podcast, 90% of everything you own at some point went on board a ship. And unfortunately, most of it has been on a foreign ship. But, you know, I want to go deeper into this. You know, I was listening to your show last week about the shipyards, and let's rewind to the beginning of our relationship. G-Captain and Midrats really started, I've been doing G-Captain now 15 years, And I got to tell you, Sal, I am at a level of frustration that I've never been at before. You invited me to come on after my last article, which said, we need to call Mayday. I love the beginning of your podcast because it's that general alarm. And we have this situation right now where the CEOs of American shipping companies and admirals and, you know, all participants in our nation are kind of patting themselves on the back. There are all these awards dinner where they give each other awards and say everything isn't as bad as you think it is. But, you know, unfortunately, I'm here to tell you it's bad. And not just in the Merchant Marine. It's my stories keep ending up being pulled back to the U.S. military, most often or not the Navy. And just the, you know, and going back, you know, let's go back 15 or 10 years. I was working for Forbes. I was a contributor on Forbes' website. And on your blog, Sal, on Galrain, on Eagle One, you guys started talking about this problem with China and the South China Sea. And, you know, I looked at that from a merchant marine perspective, and just the physical distance, you know, the physical size of the Pacific Ocean, the only way to supply, you know, a war is in the merchant marine. And I knew that we do not have the ships in order to bring the bullets, the fuel, and everything else. And I was working for Forbes at the time, and I was writing about them building these bases on the Philippine, you know, in Philippine Islands, and what they were doing to the fishermen and controlling shipping traffic. And I said, someone's got to speak out on it. And I wrote for 3 years on Forbes until I got let go. And you have to remember back then, I was the only one on the only journalist in any major organization that was writing about China. And then suddenly a few years ago, this China issue became national news. But here's the problem, Sal. When the time goes, right, and back then Forbes said I was crazy. It wasn't Forbes. They tried to help me. But all the journalists said, John Conrad's crazy. You know, he's crazy. This isn't a big issue. And everyone suppressed it, and especially Navy did a lot to suppress that article. And then suddenly they became aggressive, and we started to realize the actual ship numbers. And then there was this flood of news that came in. But no one ever came back and apologized to you, Sal, or Eagle One, or Galrain, and said, hey, you know what? You guys were right. You know, we keep, you know, and as we move forward, we because we ask the fundamental questions, are a few steps ahead of definitely the media, but also, I feel, on public policy. And we continue to be ignored until it's almost too late. You know, fast forward some more, you know, so the Forbes article didn't really make a difference. They shrugged it off. And then a few years ago, I saw that your show here and your blog, Sal, were mentioned in congressional testimony. And I'm like, wow, we got the Senate's attention. We got the Congress's attention. Now things are going to move, and they don't. And then I wrote my book on the Deepwater Horizon incident. I'm like, wow, now I testified in Congress. And I said, things are going to change. They're going to move. And wow, they don't. And then, you know, last year, I spent a significant amount of time, months of calling and helping out ProPublica with the article about the USS Fitzgerald and McCain. That article won a Pulitzer Prize, Sal. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning this year, and nothing happened. And now we have just a flow of really, really bad news. The COVID has come in, and it strained our logistical, not just our military, but our civilian logistical requirements. And I am getting these stories. I am getting these unbelievable reports. I mean, we start with the aircraft carrying COVID, and that was one thing. And then we had the Bone Arm Richard, which just boggles my mind how bad the response to that fire was. It truly incredibly horrible from a fundamental level. And then we move on. Right now there are five ships globally that are sinking right now today. There's a huge oil spill in Mauritius. It's beautiful, pristine oil. And then, you know, with the Navy, the NTSB comes out with a Fitzgerald report, and it's absolutely terrible. I mean, it doesn't even contain the stuff we found in the ProPublica. And, you know, and then we have this whole Navy turn to, right now, the latest news, and I can't confirm this, but there are rumors inside that Navy is defunding MSC. You have civilian mariners and military sealift command committing suicide at an incredible rate. Instead of sending, because they've been on the ship for almost a year, and a lot of them have no sight of getting off while the uniform come on and come off. NPR did this huge article thing. They got all the way to the Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of Defense, CMO, had a days-long meeting about it, and they come out and kind of shrug their shoulders. So, and now the Navy's moving to defund Military Sealift Command, which is absolutely critical to the supply of all of our fleet, but particularly the carrier groups. You know, they have nuclear fuel, but they need jet fuel, they need food, they need ammunition. That comes on the MSC ships. You got them turning their back on MARAD, which is already reserve fleet, which is already old and rusty and having trouble, and the Navy's turned their back on MARAD just in the last few months. And the stories go on and on and on, and I've reached a level of frustration, guys, where I there's so many stories right now, and so many of them turn back to our military, and you know, I could rant for 5 hours, but I'm frustrated even in this conversation which one to talk about. And that article that I wrote, I specifically said we do not have leadership. There's no one coming forward and telling our sailors how to handle COVID. On the military side, you know, how do we handle with this MSC? They're just saying, but stay on until you stand by. You know, we're, these guys have families. They have to go home, and they're just being told, stand by. You have deaths aboard MSC ships. You have suicide aboard MSC ships. You have COVID cases, and there's no leadership coming up and saying, this is what has to happen. And it extends to, you know, our global transportation. Right now, how are we tracking COVID? You know, what ships, crews coming into our ports, which of them have COVID, which supplies have COVID. It's being tracked by the Coast Guard. And I know they're not the Navy, but they're still military on Excel spreadsheets. And, you know, the Navy in just the last couple months has decided that they are going to turn their back on the Merchant Marine further and put billions of dollars into autonomous shipping. There are these robot ships that are going to come out. And, you know, these, you know, I feel it's a lot of aviators and submariners in the command of the Navy, but they are losing grip on the fundamentals of ship driving, the fundamentals of fighting a fire like Bonar Richard, the fundamentals of, you know, dealing with crews in a pandemic. And it's all coming to a head now. And I got to say, Sal, after I wrote that article last week, I have been in touch with the very highest levels of the U.S. government, the U.S. military, the Department of Transportation, and I am not alone. These leaders are coming to me, and they're, I mean, very high up, and they are equally as frustrated as I am. And no one seems to know how to proceed, and no one's willing to take a leadership stance on it. And no one's willing to sound that alarm and say, we are in a crisis right now. So that's my mini rant.
Well, that was a good one. Let's talk, if you had to pick, I know this is difficult, but if you had to pick five issues that you would consider to be the most important ones for whatever leader exists out there to address, what would those five issues be, John?
I have one issue that is overwhelmingly much more important than all of the rest, Sal. And it's, you know, I'm a reader. I read 2-3 books every week. And this book called Abundance really grabbed me. And the theory of the book is we have an abundance of money. We have abundance of talent. We have abundance of technology. We have abundance of smart people. We have abundance of leaders. We have abundance of everything. Even if you look at like diamonds, you know, which are highly sacred, there's really abundance of them in De Beers. fears is safe. You know, it's, we have this kind of controlled scarcity, but there's one element we do not have an abundance of. There's one element that is truly precious to all humans and is truly sacred, and that is time. We do not have an abundance of time. And if you look at what's happening now, a big part of my frustration is this COVID. And that article is specifically talking with Wall Street bankers. There is fear in Wall Street right now about the amount of money being created to sustain the economy in COVID, right? And you have these enormous, you know, the combined military budget is over $1 trillion a year, so. And it's not, you know, and that's the Navy, the Army, the Coast Guard, all combined. But you also have to look at all the Navy, NATO spending, and foreign aid, and everything else. And I keep getting these comments back from people saying, hey, look, you know, the taxpayers have to, you know, and don't get me started on the USS Zumwalt, $8 billion ship that isn't working properly. Well, the Koreans, you know, in the start of their, after Hyundai container ships went under and we kind of went in with a lull in shipping, the Korean government put out a $4.5 billion to reinvigorate the Korean merchant marine. Guess how many ships that they think that they can build with $4.5 billion? Do you guys have any guess?
40.
They think they can build 200 merchant ships with $4.5 billion. Now, we are not that efficient, but we cannot build one ship. The Zumwalt is over $8 billion. And going, you know, it all ties together. And the problem is everyone thinks linearly. So the first problem is time. The second problem is this ballooning budget. And the third is really our linear thinking. We think, we look down this shipyard problem, and we look down and we don't see how it ties to the fire on the Bonar Midship, and how it ties to the USS Fitzgerald, and how it ties to the USS Zumwalt. And I just got an amazing picture just this morning from a friend who's in San Diego Harbor. And he gave me this picture of all of the Navy ships right now at dock in San Diego. And I'm looking at this, and someone needs to be fired right this moment for this picture, because all the ships are very closely docked right next to each other, right? I mean, we are not at war. We are at peacetime. But you have to realize we do not know who our enemies are, right? There is an uncertain future ahead of us. And it's very basic, fundamental. You don't need a PhD. You don't need to conduct a McKinsey study. You don't need a historical analyst to realize that if you put all of these expensive ships right next to each other, that is an enormous target. And that was this morning, Sal. Now, you have one of those ships is $8 billion. $8 billion ship, the USS Zumwalt. And guess what? San Diego Harbor is one of the only harbors that does not have a fireboat. How do we have so tens of billions of dollars of Navy equipment all next to each other and not one single fireboat within hundreds of miles? So this is what I'm talking about at the level of crisis right now. You know, and I want to talk, you know, it's hard to tie all this together, and the Navy has an answer for everything. Well, we have air defense, and this is why we can bring it over. And we have this contingency plan where we can pull the ships off. And we have tugboats in the harbor that have firefighting equipment, civilian tugboats. Well, those tugboats, guys, they asked to help with the Bonar Midship fire. They got on the VHF and begged to come in and help, and they were turned down because the Navy does not train with these merchant mariners in the port. They don't know who to call. So instead, they brought these little police boats with these little water cannons and tried to put out this fire, and it failed. So this all connects together, and I get a lot of negative feedback from the Navy. I'm probably going to get an admiral yelling at me when they hear this podcast, but I'll be on. But the Navy gets very mad at some things, and you are not a naval officer, John. You know, I spent 1 year at the Naval Academy. I had to leave because my dad was sick with cancer. But I'm not a naval officer, but I tell them, when I was a ship captain, this electrician fell down the ladder well once. All right, Sal, he fell down the ladder well and tumbled over many times. It was a two-story ladder well. And we sound the general alarm, we get the medical team, we get everyone else, and I'm looking, and this guy's bleeding all over himself, right, Sal? He's just bleeding, and his arms pinned back in an unnatural angle, and I call the doctor. We happen to have a doctor on this ship, and the doctor comes over, and he looks at this guy, bleeding and everything else, and all his tools, all his diagnostic tools were in the hospital. That was his comfort zone. He was not comfortable on the deck of the ship. He was comfortable. So this doctor looks at the electrician and says, "Get up. Let's walk to the hospital." And I was like, whoa. I am not a doctor. I was just an EMT for a couple of years. I don't know anything about medical. But I know that you do not get a cervical patient to walk to the hospital. All right, so I don't have your advanced degree. I don't have anything. I am not an expert in your field. I just know the very basics. But I know that you are committing a very basic thing here. And the doctor got all angry at me, and he says, "Who are you? You're not a doctor." And I fired him. I kicked him off the ship, Sal. And it went on to corporate, and it went all the way up to the CEO, and they had lawyers involved, and they said, "John, you can't tell a doctor what to do." And it was a year-long trial until I was finally redeemed by a major doctor. But that's what I feel like now. I feel like the Merchant Marine is tumbling, but also these various segments of the Navy, like firefighting response, like navigation, like shipyard design. You got these patients tumbling down the ladder and the CNO coming in and saying, "Come on, get up, let's walk to the hospital." And I do not know how the Navy works. I'm not a naval expert, but I know that this is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, there's so much that happened in San Diego that, and we've talked about it here, and I think a lot of us have written about it as well, that is still perplexing with that fire. And, you know, I think part of the problem, and you've hit on this on a regular basis, and it sounds cliche, but it is true. A lot of it goes back to leadership and where their focus is. And sometimes we take these senior officers and we give them areas of responsibility for 24, even 36 months. By the time they unpack their household goods and figure out how to mow the yard correctly, they're already looking at their next set of orders. So they're not focused on San Diego, if that's where they are, or Bremerton or Norfolk. They're focused on D.C. or they're focused on Millington.
Right.
And I think you can see part of that, and part of the conversation, you mentioned something very interesting, because I find it irritating. First of all, I am a technology geek. I love thinking about the future. But I try to keep one handhold, you know, firmly on the now. And this push to autonomous shipping, and I may actually write something about it this week, but there's a huge disconnect where we verbalize and talk about the great thing about American mariners is the quality. And company, country X or Y may have more ships and more mariners, but ours are better than theirs. But at the same time, you're pushing autonomous shipping decoupled from what we've already seen about maintenance and safety. And I wanted to take a second to pull the thread also on the impact of what everybody's talking about the last 7 months, and that's COVID. There's already been a manning crunch to get qualified mariners to choose this profession. And one of the stories I read mentioned a nice little data point, and I don't know how you recruit the future when you have things that you outlined as well, where if you're uniformed, you can come on and off the ship. If you're not on uniform, you know, you're indentured servitude on board the ship. But the International Transport Workers Federation back in August, these are August numbers, they estimated 300,000 of their 1.2 million crew members were stranded on their ships after their contracts. And there's a heartbreaking story, and you know these people better than I do, but some of the best people in the merchant fleet throughout the world are Filipinos. They're great mariners, hard work, And one of the individuals.
There are over 100,000 of those Filipinos. I could not agree more that are stuck on the ship right now, and over 100,000 that are home and can't pay the bills because they're out of work because they can't get on the ship.
This one individual hadn't left the ship in 18 months. 18 months. This guy. How do you restrict the future?
We have five ships right now leaking oil internationally. But it's a very simple solution, right? What do people want? It's leadership. They want respect. The CNO is not getting up and standing in front of these MSC mariners and doing an all-hands message. He's not visiting the civilian ships. And on a national level, Admiral Busby's doing some really, really great things, but he's really frustrated talking with the military and trying to get the military lined up. And then you have the IMO, which is, we don't have very many votes in the International Maritime Organization, and the Coast Guard is kind of in the leadership position there for us. But no one in the IMO, there's no ship on Maersk. The CEO of Maersk isn't getting out on the ships and talking to the mariners. The port authorities aren't. There's no one standing up in leadership, and it's basic respect, right, Sal? How do you recruit people? How do you recruit people in the merchant marine? I mean, it seems so obvious to me. In World War II, we did it with the U.S. Merchant Service. We gave these guys free training and free support, free health care. We gave them free health care. We built marine hospitals around the country. Before the VA hospitals, there were marine hospitals for merchant mariners where they had free health care. Before, Navy veterans had it. And we've disassembled all of these things, and we've taken away the uniform, and they don't feel like part of the team. It is the Navy sending a clear message. We treat the Navy uniform officers better than you do. And they have the problem is the Navy's got and the military's got all of these excuses, Sal, all of these excuses not to treat humans like they need to be treated. And that is what is just most frustrating for me. Is it's not that hard to make the merchant mariners feel part of the team, restore the U.S. Merchant Service, give them back the uniform, maybe not make them full veterans. You know, I can't tell you how many flag officers have told me, well, if we give the merchant mariners, VA's basic health care or anything else, then we got to give all contractors basic health care. Well, merchant mariners are the only contractors, civilian contractors, who command major NATO assets. We have a merchant mariners right now in command of major naval assets at sea, NATO assets at sea. This is, and they're being told, basically, our people are more important than you. You are a civilian. You're a contractor. We're not going to give you any support. We're not going to let you off the ship. And people are frustrated.
How much?
And then what was the
other
question? Autonomy. You said autonomy. Go ahead. What was your question?
Well, I was going to ask on with respect to our merchant fleet. How much do you think? And it's talking about leadership. How much do you think the change is that went back in the old days, shipping companies were run by people who had actually been to sea? How much do you think the effect of large, I want to say Wall Street types, taking over some of these shipping companies, and they don't have, they're in it for the bottom line, not necessarily for the shipping. Is that an issue in the way this stuff is working out?
It is, and it's really, particularly the Navy, but the DOD blocking a lot of the private investment. So you look at the shipyards, and the Navy controls the shipyards. And I think, if you look at the Korean shipyards are very well efficient run, and nothing stops the production line. Nothing. Once they cut the first thing of steel, nothing stops it. Yet you have a Navy, 12 guys with a clipboard on a Navy ship right now shutting down shipyards, which are driving up these costs. And, I could talk for hours about shipyards, but That's just one issue. Now you have these billions of dollars going into autonomous systems. You talk about a technologist. I actually, for the last 6 months, have been working for an MIT startup, which is founded by Dr. Muhammad Saad, and he is the top autonomy guy in the world. He had a successful pilot. He did the only fully autonomous commercial ship in Finland for Rolls-Royce, and he's worked at MIT Robotics Lab, and he has some of the best algorithms in the world right now. The Navy's not calling us. The Navy's not getting engaged in this startup. The Navy's not doing its homework. ONR's kind of being a little bit more progressive. But where does the Navy turn? The Navy is turning to the big defense contractors who can't get the technology delivered and are going to drive up costs. They're not going into the startup world. They're not going. And that was part of my frustration in this article. You know, for one reason or another, the U.S. has expanded its power, its influence in the world maritime thing exponentially over the last 10 years, and no one realizes it. So 10 years ago, we were something like number 12 in terms of the number of ships that were financed by American companies, right? The global ship population. Now, thanks to hedge funds, derivatives, and all these fintech things which cut and slice and leverage, U.S. is now number one in ship finance. So everyone says there's no money to build the commercial ships. Well, we're number one in finance, but we can't build the banks. We can't amortize and cut up and derivatize a Jones Act tanker, and we can't do it without naval approval. And there's no financial expertise within the Navy to understand these advanced derivative and contracts of the Wall Street bankers. So that's how that article started. It's the bankers frustrated. They can't loan to shipyards. They can't loan to commercial entities because the Navy won't approve it because it's too complicated. And then I talked to the technology world. There's no technology. You have 25% of the S&P 500 right now, a full 25% is our top five tech companies. And they've completely ignored the U.S. Navy, and they've completely ignored the Merchant Marine. And then this company called Flexport came out in New York. It was started in Columbia Business School, and they hired ship captains and some Navy guys, and they tried to get financing from the ship community, and they were turned away. So they flew to San Francisco, fired all the ship guys, and rebranded themselves as a logistics company. Now they're a multi-billion-dollar unicorn, Sal. And the Navy had an opportunity to work with them. The Merchant Marine had an opportunity to work with them, and we dropped the ball. And now they're getting financed by China and the Japanese. So you have, I forget what the other issue is, but, you know, and all this money is going into the cyber security, and it's a huge issue. I agree fully. But our ports, our commercial ports, are being run off Excel spreadsheets while the Navy's going out and bidding for billion-dollar cybersecurity things. They're leaving the Coast Guard with these spreadsheets. And don't get me started on the Navy, you know, stepping on the feet of the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard continuously has this minute budget. What is the number one threat of everyone's talking about in the Pentagon right now? It's a peer-to-peer battle. It's a battle against peers. Well, who are the peers? Number one is China. They have repeatedly said they are going up to the Arctic in a war, and they're going to fight an Arctic war. And number two is Russia, which always, historically, always withdraws its fleet to protect the homeland, and that's their plan in the next war. And we don't have a single icebreaker that works. The two Coast Guard icebreakers have been catching fire. We don't have one reliable icebreaker right now, yet we have an $8 billion Zumwalt. Well, we can build two icebreakers and refurbish the entire MARAD fleet for less than that $8 billion bill. And you talk about it all the time. We need basic destroyers. We don't need $3 billion LCSs where, you know, just listening to, we've decommissioned four, and how many do we have still that are building? Like, okay, we spent $8 billion on the Zen Vault. It doesn't work. I get it. We have to push technology. It didn't work. Failed experiment. But now we're building two more. It's just, it doesn't, everyone thinks this is complicated, and they look at the contracts and they look at the thing. But what I do and what the technologists do, you know, one of my best friends is COO of Facebook, initial COO, and we talk about this stuff all the day. But if you actually go, and it's different now, but when I lived outside of Silicon Valley 10 years ago, you could go there and you could sit down with these guys, and you think they're all on Twitter and they're all doing all these things on their devices. But no, they're on the phone and they're at coffee shops. And what is the conversation of the coffee shops? It's not about these AI advanced algorithms and the billions of dollars they need, like you hear from the Navy today. It is about the fundamentals. They ask each other the most basic questions. At the core of human psychology. And, you know, the military did this too. And if you look at, I don't know how much you guys know about it, but I've been putting a lot of focus over the last few years on John Boyd and the military reform movement of the early 80s. But, you know, all of these, the balloon of these costs and these very fundamental problems was ballooning in the 70s. The nation almost collapsed, and then this Air Force colonel came in and started to use the media to leverage Congress to get these reforms. So we can fix this, but how much more time do we have? We're paying, you know, these bankers are saying we're paying interest payments on this $1 trillion a year military budget. And I want, and we're not getting our basic needs. We're not building fire boats in San Diego. We're not building salvage. When I was at the Naval Academy, they brought in the big salvage tugs. We don't have that. We don't have the logistical tankers. We don't have the cargo ships. We don't. The Navy's completely turned its back on all of these working ships, the destroyers, and these things that win wars, and has put all its baskets in, you know, autonomy technology. And by the way, we need to fund huge amounts of cyber, because we know the Chinese, once we put the $1 billion in automation, they're just going to steal our secrets. So that's why we need to put billions more into cybersecurity to protect those secrets, because we can't right now.
Yeah, that's the Achilles heel for all this stuff, is the communications path, and it's the cyber part of the equation. And smart people know it, but unfortunately they don't share it, because it's all behind the cipher lock. And I wanted to ask, you know, when you talk about levers of power, and you know, you mentioned the problem you have with the Navy. You've listened to some of our shows with other guests. There is so much dysfunction right now. The Navy can't, even in the naval aviation side of the house, it's the Hornet guys will sell anybody else into indentured servitude on a sugar plantation in the Caribbean if they can buy another half dozen Super Hornets. I mean, it's to ask Navy right now under present leadership to think broadly.
Who designed the Super Hornet?
Yeah.
who designed the Hornet? Do you know?
Oh, the original Hornet lost out to Boyd's baby out in the 70s, the F-16.
Right. It was, you know, and Boyd got the two defense contractors to fight each other off, and then it was the Hornet and the F-16, and the F-16 won. And he was going to put a tail hook on it, but the Navy says, we're not dealing with you. And right after that happened, you know, and he pushed the military reform movement. You know, the military doesn't realize that the power, you know, we can't get Congress to do anything. Well, the power of Congress really comes from the media, unfortunately, and the media is broken. But the Navy refuses to talk to you. I can't tell you how much, you know, every time I talk to someone in the Pentagon or anywhere in the government, as a journalist, they go on and on about how much deadwood is in their department. They know what the problems are. They know where the spending's going. They are as frustrated as I am. But they say, John, I said, can you go on the record with us? Well, first they say, there's nothing we can do. These are all government contracts, government employees. I can't fire these people. You know, high-level admirals are saying, I can't fire these people in this department. I just can't. That's how government works. And then their next comment, I said, can you go on the record? Well, no, I can't talk to the media or I'll get fired. It's like, which is it? You know? And Boyd was set to be a Air Force general, and then the Air Force knocked him down to colonel. And I was just in Dayton, Ohio last year, and I went to the Air Force Museum, beautiful museum, and I walked around all day looking for the name of John Boyd, and it's not there. And his number two there was Chuck Spinney in this military reform unit. And Chuck Spinney just had a conference about Boyd's theories, and he talks about the Navy, and he talks about the Fitzgerald, and he says the Navy is sold on this 100% awareness. You know, that's the CIC and the Fitzgerald. This 100% awareness, and most of the military is, they want these soldiers that have the heads-up display, and they have the robotic arms, and they have 24/7. But he says the Navy should know this, the fundamentals, better than everyone. Because when they launch airplanes, you look at the Airbus, and they still use a whiteboard. They still use these very basic terms to land the planes, because that is dangerous. You know, they don't have the CIC. They don't have a whole bunch of kids with headsets looking at it into a radar. They got an Airbus, and you look down on the deck, and there's a guy with a red vest, and there's a guy with a yellow vest, and everything is very analog. And then once the planes are up, the Air Force leaves, everything goes to CIC, and we have this total awareness and total technology driven. And I love technology too, but that's what John Boyd figured out as the mix. You know, how do we, and really at the core of John Boyd's and its philosophy, you know, he designed the Gulf War I, our most successful war. He did the military planning. Is he talked about Heidelberg's theory, Gödel's theory. He talked about entropy and the law of dynamics. He got down to fundamentals of fighting war on a level of basic physics and mathematics. Much more fundamental than I'm talking about not having a fireboat with an $8 billion asset. And that's what I think we have to do. Boyd was brilliant about managing chaos theory, but the Navy and most of the military thinks linearly. I got this problem and this budget, and it's got to be spent by here, and I got to please that congressman, and I got to please that senator, and I got to get the defense contractors, and it's just this linear thing where the world is complicated now. We cannot rely on linear thinking. We have to rely on complexity theory and chaos theory if we are going to win a war in the future.
Well, from the this is not a drill, this is not a drill. If we don't have time to get the Navy to turn to, what about other areas where you can't influence and change things? Leave the Pentagon to its PowerPoint for a second. I think there's a lot of things that restrain and constrain our merchant marine development from a regulatory point of view. That's in the executive branch. But also you have to look at the legislative. Back when you and I were wee little boys, there were congressmen and senators who they weren't in the back pocket. Maybe they were in the back pocket of commercial maritime interests, but they were very knowledgeable and they were very focused on it. So legislatively and regulatory, you can move some things. Who are the advocates, if we have any right now, up on the Hill, Congress and Senate, that get it and we can rely on? Or does there need to be a sustained effort to educate and grow new ones?
Absolutely, and we have some great advocates. Gare Mundy's absolutely number one. You got Congressman Mike Gallagher. Unfortunately, he's putting, also really a supporter of this LCS project, which I think is a failure. And the Norfolk Congresswoman, I forget her name. But the problem is that Congress is broken, and everyone's looking at, we need these desperate, strengthen the Jones Act. We need to allow the Wall Street in order to finance the rebuilding of the shipyards and the building of the U.S. ships. We need all this, and you're right, it comes down to legislative. But, everyone has these assumptions, Sal. They have this assumption that, the congressmen don't care about maritime. Of course they care. But all of the maritime districts in the House of Representatives and Congress, you know, New York, California, Texas, Florida, they all have huge social problems. So money gets really diverted to farm and farm aid because the senator in North Dakota, that's all he cares about. Where in the maritime states, the senators really have these bigger issues. It's not that they don't care about the Navy and maritime issues. It's that they have these bigger issues. And, you know, the bigger problem is what is the most I came up with a theory, you know, what is the most dangerous idea ever developed by man? And it's an idea that man came up with in the history of the world. And this realization is what's causing me to yell a little bit here, Sal. This is what's causing me to say we don't have time. Time's the only precious thing. This is what's causing me to sound the alarm right now. It's the most dangerous idea that man has ever come up with is the idea of divide and conquer. And you look at the Imperial British, how well they did it in India. But it goes back to the splitting of the five Jewish nations. In Roman times, it goes back to Machiavelli, and, you know, fast forward, we are, you know, Hitler used it, and the Holocaust, and you have all of these. No single idea of mankind has caused more pain, suffering, death, war, and just darkness than the concept of divide and conquer. And you look at right now what is happening to the United States. We are being divided. We are being divided at the core. And I don't know who's dividing us. Is it the media? Is it the corporations? Is it foreign interests? Is it, you know, some dark players behind the thing? I don't know. But we are being divided. And what happens after being divided? We are being conquered. So I believe we can get, you know, and I tell everyone, don't write your congressman, don't write your senator over these maritime issues because they just don't listen. You know, I've been writing them for 15 years. And as Einstein says, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results, which I think the Navy is and the Merchant Marine are just have been doing the last 30 years. But you have to align what. You know, and the Navy War College invited me to Brown Rain to talk about why does it used to be that the Navy, you know, found these areas of threat in the world and then, you know, did a military action and then the news would report on it. More and more often now, the news comes out and then the Pentagon has to go and respond. And this was the Navy War College saying, you know, how do we, you know, the social media, you know, how the biggest, you know, maritime blog. And I said, you know, it comes down to really the media has power because congressmen need votes. And everyone's on Twitter and Facebook and social media right now. So they want to listen to the Merchant Marine and fund this. They want to listen to the Navy and clamp down on spending and the Zumwalt and put more destroyers out there. But really, we are being run by tweets right now. If you look at watch the movie The Social Dilemma on Netflix and how insidious these social networks are and how they are changing politics, I don't think the Navy really understands how the political structure is being changed by this media and how we're being divided as a country, and we will be conquered. And it's looking like it's happening sooner than I thought. So, you know, you have to figure out how do we align these interests? And there are some very basic ways. I know senators, or at least Senator Aides, listen to your podcast. So I'm going to tell you, Sal, if a Senator Aide or a senator is listening right now, I can tell you how to have extreme power. And this is a very simple thing. All right. You can be president of the United States. And you just have to look at historical context. Look at the Truman Committee in World War II. The Truman Committee investigated these, you know, run-up in costs, like we're seeing with the Zumwalt and the LCS. And the Truman Committee was very interesting. One thing is they weren't trying to criminalize these companies. They weren't trying to lock people up in jail. They actually were trying to find these problems in the shipyards and in the manufacturing plants in order to boost production and make the companies more money. you know, the shipyards are not making a lot of money right now because they are tied down to this. So Truman came in, and what did he do? He investigated this, but he did it by asking very, very fundamental questions, almost dumb idiot-type questions about the very fundamentals of how this worked, and he tied them together, not just the shipyards, but the arms manufacturer and the trade and the merchant ships. And he investigated all of it by asking a very simple question. And then he wasn't putting blame. It was not his thing to put blame. You know, he wanted a solution for the country. And then, you know, some of these he put out in the press. And this is how we get the national thing. But it was this very simple committee. And then what happened? It was so powerful. It did so much. I think they saved $14 billion in World War II off of this committee, and FDR goes, this is an amazing job, I make you vice president. Fast forward to the Korean War, LBJ did the China War, you know, Korean War Preparedness Committee. Same thing. It wasn't looking to blame admirals and defense contractors and anything else, and he took a lot out of the report, but it was asking very fundamental questions. And here's something else LBJ and Truman did. They didn't do it from an office cell. They didn't do it from inside the Pentagon. And they went to the shipyards. They put their boots on. They talked to the line workers. They talked to junior naval officers. They spent time in the factories. And what happened? LBJ becomes vice president. Now you go again to the first Gulf War. You had Schwarzkopf came up and he had this very complicated plan for invading Iraq. And Cheney said, investigated that plan, said it wouldn't work, and flew John Boyd, now retired, up from the Florida to the Pentagon. And he famously wrote the war plan on a napkin. But he investigated, not to blame, not to try to destroy the careers of these admirals like the media often does, but in order to come up with a better plan, a better strategy in these complex times. So, you know, I in my last video, I asked, you know, I call on Mitch McConnell, it's let's do a Senate investigative hearing on our preparedness for a peer-to-peer war. The time is now, and it has to be not looking to blame, looking to align the goals so the Wall Street and the shipyards and the naval officers and the merchant marine can all benefit. And it has to be boots on the ground. You know, you have to call up the people who are in the trenches, and that's you, Sal. You know, and that's, you know, Eagle One, and that's Chew Captain, and that's, you know, the managers and the bankers. Everything now is siloed. So then I never see a Navy officer at a cruise ship conference, and I never see a cruise ship guy at a tanker conference, and I never see a tanker guy in the IMO, International Maritime Organization. And we all live in these silos because the world's gotten so complex. And our jobs have been getting so complex that we've narrowed our focus, and now we're all tunnel blind. And that's fine. Maybe we do. We got to rely on experts. But every once in a while, and this is what John Boyd said, it's destruction and creation. You got to eliminate that tunnel blindness for a while, all come together in a very to simplify the process, try to simplify, destroy the complexity, and then you go back to building the complexity, and it's destroy, creation. So I think, you know, unless we do that, get back to the basics with an investigation in the Senate, I frankly, I've lost faith that we can get the legislature through.
Well, your analogy is pretty good. Let me go back to something you said earlier, and was also appeared in your article, which was that you were talking about the farmers in South Dakota who may not care about shipbuilding, but in reality, if we weren't sea blind, and he thought about it, he would care about shipbuilding, because where is his grain going? A lot of it goes to Houston, gets loaded on ships and sent overseas. I mean, that's why you're absolutely right about when you rail against siloization of these things. You know, it is not a problem of merchant marine. It's not a problem of the Navy. It is a national problem. The farmers, our factory workers, Everyone has to understand that we are highly dependent on the sea, not only for bringing goods into this country, but for shipping stuff out of this country, the products that we do send out, and that we don't have an adequate merchant marine right now, and we don't have an adequate navy right now to protect our goods. I think your points are well made. And I think you
we don't have the working, we don't have the working, you know, and I believe we have a green navy right now, and I believe some of this technology is good, and I believe we should put in automation, but we've turned our back on core port infrastructure, roads, bridges. We've turned our back on core ugly bulkers and tankers. We've turned our back on destroyers and salvage tugs and Navy fireboats. We've turned our back on the core industrial, the things that supply that war, that feed that war, right? And the fundamental idea is, like, you don't stick all of your billion-dollar assets right in the piers right next to each other, 20 ships, you know, together. These fundamentals. That's why I rail in my article. I don't feel like these problems are very difficult to fix if we get the right people in the room. And I go back to my captains. You know, I was on the best, most technologically advanced ship. We used to have Wall Street investors all come and look at this. This is the best ship run by Americans in the world. And I was chief mate, and it was a complete mess. It was a complete mess because everyone was kind of sticking each other in the back. And I've been on the worst ship in the U.S. merchant ship. This old tanker that didn't have any electronics on it. And I love working on that ship because you had a bunch of people who were, you know, John Boy says the most important distance in any battle is 6 inches, 6 inches between the ears, right? If you get motivated, positive people who are willing to cut through BS and solve problems, you can do it. But it takes the leaders. You got to have the bank. You got to have Navy guys in Wall Street banks with the tanker guys, with the, you know, firefighting, marine firefighting experts, with trade analysts, with the farmers. You know, you have to figure out how to align everyone's interests for the same goal. But right now, budgets are so weak for these working ships that every time a little bit of money is available, it's like throwing a stake into a pit of starving dogs. Everyone bites each other and yells at each other. That's mine. And we end up fighting each other. Even that article, you know, there are a couple memes on Facebook right now making fun of John Conrad and some people who are very, very mad at me. So, you know, we tend to punch each other because we're all starving for attention. We're all starving for funds. We're all starving for, you know, the basic needs of being led, right?
As coming to the end of the hour, I thought I'd look down the road a little bit here, and we kind of answered part of our questions with some of the problems we outlined earlier. However, in a different industry, my daughters are in college, and I was talking to a young man in school with my youngest daughter in the forestry. He's going to major in forestry. And one thing that he was talking about is there's a little bit of a crisis in the forestry industry because for decades, whether everybody from those that know how to run a log loader to people who understand the math of how to turn raw timber into profit, was dominated by baby boomers. And they are rapidly, rapidly retiring. Many of them who are still in the business don't understand some of the latest methods that can increase margins. And so there's a great opportunity here for smart men and women who are looking for a future to go into forestry. And part of their frustration at some of the major universities is getting career counselors to be able to explain the benefits of it. And the good thing is they're actually paying people good money now. Let's look at that human portion of the U.S. merchant marine. What are some things, if John Conrad had a couple of billion dollars burning a hole in his left pocket and had the ability to help establish programs and messaging, what are some of the things that we could do to make this career path more enticing to young men and women looking for a future, assuming that we can keep the economics such that we're not lying to them? What are some things that we could do to help that labor shortage?
Well, this topic is very important to me. And if you go, I keep bringing up John Boyd, but if you go back to him, he says, people first, then ideas, then technology. Not that technology is important. Got to be people driven. You know, the one thing that Admiral Busby of Maryland has been done extremely well is he got a national security vessel for each of the Merchant Marine academies. And, you know, we're putting huge, what's the cybersecurity building in Annapolis, and there's some funding with NOR and the Centers of Excellence and Navy War College. The one we're failing at is the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy in Kings Point is not getting funding. And there's a lot of pushback. And then one is, I think their operating budget's $121 million, and they say, you know, this is just, to get senators so that they can get congressmen. I said, you know, well, this is our future. This is our education. These are the people that will be in the future. And guess what, Sal? Education is free. If we invest in education, you know how many shipping companies, how many port logistics companies have been started by U.S. Merchant Marine Academy alumni? You know, and all of those companies now contribute to the tax base. They use innovation and teaching is they create economic which feeds the nation. But, you know, I talked to Admiral Busby about this in my own alma mater, SUNY Maritime College, and there's a big question of how are we, you know, there's such uncertainty in the future. How do we train these midshipmen and cadets? How do we get them ready for a future workforce which we don't know about? And I say, first of all, you have to look at the fundamentals. And the fundamentals are world population is growing exponentially. People are moving back into the city. And there is very limited real estate in the city. So we will be forced to, as we already are doing, wind farms and extra docks and short sea shipping initiatives, getting cargo off of trucks and onto boats. There's just $60 million grant in New York City to do that because they are in such crisis right now with their infrastructure. So the maritime future is very bright, but we don't know, is it going to be LNG? Is it going to be these wind farms? Is it going to be war? Is it going to be a maritime cyber threat? We don't know how to, you know, they don't know where to invest those education dollars. And I say it's very, very simple. There are two things. So I'm a huge proponent. We need to, I say double, even triple Kings Point U.S. Merchant Marine Academy's budget, like right now. And then, you know, what do you teach them? And I go back to, you know, I spent time in Silicon Valley. I know the founders of Facebook. I've been at the meeting. And again, they ask very fundamental, dumb questions. They talk about AI and they talk about, but those guys know the basic code, the one and zero. They know how the computer operates. And that's what allowed them to build these complexities. So I think we need in an education, we got to get down to basics. You got to teach the knots. You got to teach basic naval architecture. You got to be able to teach them how to drive without, autopilot helm or without DP. You have to teach them how to back to rowing boats and working together as a team and get that fundamental. Let's get that foundational work as strong as possible. Build that foundation in our youth. And forget about all of these algorithms and everything. Double down on the core seamanship, the core mathematics, the core physicists. That's part one. Part two, I think it's just as important. We have to teach these young students an agile mindset. We don't know if they're going to go in the oil industry. You know, the Merchant Marine collapsed, and then there were still some tankers, and then that collapsed, and everyone went offshore, that collapsed, and now the cruise ships are collapsing, right? We don't know what the next thing is, so we have to give them the ability to go out and use YouTube and use training to give them the technical skills they need after school, and with that foundational knowledge and a agile mindset, we got to get everyone at the Maritime Academies. I talked to them, and they're all worried. They're all frustrated. They said there are no U.S. Merchant Marine jobs. Well, there are jobs on ferries. There are jobs on foreign flagships. There are jobs on drilling rigs. But they're so focused on the merchant marine jobs, they don't see all of the opportunities around them. And they don't know how, after graduation, to give them the skills, the specialized skills, in order to go for these other jobs. So it's really a mindset problem. If you have the fundamentals, you have the ability to have the mindset to navigate a increasingly complex and foggy future. And that means maneuver, be agile. And you have the ability to invest in these core tools, these technology tools on your own after graduation. I think that's how, you know, we build. And I think that's the important. Look, I'm huge on ships, and if I had a few billion dollars, I'd go and investigate the shipyards myself, and I bring in the Korean experts who can pump out 200 ships for $4.5 billion. And I would tell the Navy, we gotta move the production. We can't shut down. And we could fix those shipyards, but, you know, the honest truth, and people don't like to hear this, is in every war in history, we have not had the merchant marine that we needed. So what do? We requisitioned foreign ships. We took over foreign ships, but the difference today is we don't have enough mariners to man the ships that we have. How are we going to man the ships that we take in war? So I think that is the absolute critical. It starts in that classroom. It starts in the maritime academies and the service academies. And you're absolutely right about the logging and the thing. They need to know the fundamentals, and then they have to be taught that the future's uncertain, it's complex, be agile, and use these new tools. You know, you can go on MIT right now and you can get a whole degree for free online. But, you know, you can't get the fundamentals of navigating a ship. You can't get the experience of being in the winter North Atlantic. But that's what the academies have to teach.
That is a very good place to stop for today, John. You've been brilliant for over an hour, and I want to thank you for coming on with us today. And I'll ask what we should ask, which is what have you got in the hopper that we can look forward to in the next few weeks or so?
Well, I continue. I posted the video, the article that you talked about, and then I posted a video where I unfortunately I broke down in tears, literally crying for help. You know, to get an organization or something, to get the Senate to investigate these fundamental issues. That, like you said, the mariners are stuck out there. There are five ships sinking in the world right now. We lose on average one ship every week globally. Big ships. Doesn't enter the news. And right now it's getting worse, exponentially worse. And the Navy's having problems, merchant marines. So I'm focused on that. I have that video where I actually break down in tears asking for help. And then I have another video coming out hopefully tomorrow where I say, you know, what can you do? Because everyone says, John, I want to help, but no one really knows how to help. So I'm going to do that. Hopefully, well, you know, your Senate, your friends in the Senate will hear this and start a very simple core investigation of military preparedness for a peer-to-peer war. And hopefully I can participate in that. And I'm also working, again, with this MIT startup, Black Sail, on some of this autonomy and technology and the future there, which I also think is important as long as it's an add-on to the fundamentals, right? You need that. You need the destroyers, you need the merchant ships, you need the salvage tug, and then you add technology onto it. And it's all based on a good education system and sailors who know how to operate ships.
And on that note, thank you very much, John. It's been a great hour again. And I wish you luck for the rest of 2020. And hopefully 2021 will be a little better for us. Look forward to the next time talking to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you for pushing this for the last – how many years have you guys been doing this now?
Over a decade. Yeah.
Over a decade. So I don't know why you're not as frustrated as me, but I see some of your posts. I can feel that frustration. Right? And I thank you. I thank you for continuing to post, all of you and all the bloggers out there who are writing about these issues.
Appreciate it. We need more passion out there, and I appreciate everybody who took time today for joining us for another edition of Midrat. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell.